You're listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the curtain at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features in-depth interviews with the singers, conductors, and creative minds behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.
John Adams, Peter Sellers, Gerald Finley, and James Cuno are backstage at Lyric.
Opera is this total work of art. It should be inclusive. It should stretch all the boundaries, and it's about a shared, collaborative space. You know, which is one of the things we have to demonstrate to politicians every day. What does it mean to collaborate? What does it mean that there are multiple and differing points of view, and we are finding a home for them all on stage? And sophisticated adults are communicating with each other at very high levels of detail and with enormous attention.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of one of the world's great opera companies. I'm Roger Pines of Lyric Opera of Chicago. For this episode, we're playing an audio transcript of the first of three panel discussions from the Lyric Opera Discovery Series Symposium on Dr. Atomic. For those of you who may not be aware of the Discovery Series, it's panel discussions featuring singers, conductors, directors, and scholars. We do one session per opera. They usually take place a few days prior to the opening of each production. The Discovery Series is open to the public, and it's a great way to get up close and personal with our artists. You can check out our website at www.lyricopera.org for dates, tickets, and complete Discovery Series information. We're including all the Discovery Series sessions as part of the Backstage at Lyric podcast. The first session in our Dr. Atomic Symposium features composer John Adams, director librettist Peter Sellers, baritone Gerald Finley, and Art Institute of Chicago president and Eloise W. Martin director James Cuno. The moderator is Wynne Delacoma, an adjunct faculty member at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism and former music critic of the Chicago Sun-Times. I hope you enjoy the discussion.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Jim Cuno, and I'm the president and director of the Art Institute of Chicago, and it's a great pleasure to be with you, I think only in Chicago and perhaps, bless you, and perhaps in Siberia, would any this number of people venture out on a day like today. Smiles on your faces and curiosity in your minds. We're grateful that you're here. This is a program of great distinction, I think, in the cultural life of the city of Chicago. It's a program part of our year-long season exploring various artistic perspectives on the American experience, a collaboration between the Art Institute and our colleague cultural institutions throughout the city. Today, we're pleased to be collaborating with the Lyric Opera of Chicago to consider the Lyric's forthcoming production of Dr. Atomic, a recent opera composed by our nation's leading composer, John Adams, in collaboration with the virtuoso theater and opera director and librettist, Peter Sellers. The relevance of this opera to the city of Chicago, Professor Fermi and his lab at the University of Chicago, is well known to all of us. Suffice it to say that with the recent news of Iran, Pakistan, and North Korea, the theme of the opera and the legacy of the Manhattan Project, the presentation of the opera in Chicago is especially charged right now. I will leave it to others to say more about the structure of today's symposium. Let me simply urge you to look through the brochure for the season American Perspectives, available, I think, out front, to find additional programs of exhibitions, lectures, concerts, poetry readings, and literary events here at the Art Institute and throughout the city. And now it's my very great pleasure to introduce our good friend, the General Director of the Lyric Opera, Bill Mason.
Thank you. It's my great privilege and pleasure to welcome you today to this symposium on Dr. Atomic by John Adams with a libretto by Peter Sellers. I want to give our special thanks to the Art Institute for their collaboration and providing this wonderful venue for this event. Dr. Atomic by John Adams is an operatic portrayal of an event that changed the course of human history, the detonation of the world's first atomic bomb and the race to build it. Most of the characters portrayed in the opera are real historical figures, and much of what they sing is what these people actually said or wrote. The opera explores the complex moral dilemmas facing them as they stand at the brink of a horrifying but irresistibly compelling scientific breakthrough. Today's historic gathering of artists, scientists, and scholars will be divided into three sessions. The first panel will be the composer of Dr. Atomic, John Adams, librettist and director Peter Sellers, Gerald Finley, who portrays Robert Oppenheimer in the opera, James Cuno, president of the Art Institute, and music critic Wynne Della Coma as moderator. They'll discuss opera and the arts in the nuclear age. After a five-minute break, a new panel will convene composed of a Pulitzer Prize-winning J. Robert Oppenheimer biographer, Martin Sherwood, Henry Frisch, a renowned physicist at the University of Chicago's Fermi Institute and keeper of the Bulletin of American Scientists' Doomsday Clock, and Nobel Prize winner Norman Ramsey, who was one of Oppenheimer's chief physicists at the Los Alamos Project during the Manhattan Project. They will discuss the history and the science behind the opera. This panel will be moderated by National Public Radio's Peter Sagal. After a 10-minute break, the third session will bring all the panelists together and the moderators for a question and answer period. First, the panelists will have a chance to question one another, and then they will take questions from you, the audience. If you have a question, please write it down on the note cards provided at the door. The cards will be collected during the breaks between the sessions by Lyric staff members who will be posted around the auditorium in the lobby area. The second break will be your last chance to turn in your questions. And may I ask you also to hold on to your ticket stubs for re-entry into the auditorium. Before we begin, let me express our sincere thanks to the Catherine A. Abelson Educational Endowment Fund for helping to make this symposium possible. Lyric's production of Dr. Atomic was generously made possible by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, Barbara and Richard Franke, LaSalle Bank, the Boeing Company, and the National Endowment for the Arts. There are still tickets left for Dr. Atomic, and you can go on Lyric's website, lyricopera.org, to purchase them. And if you enjoy what you hear this afternoon and want to listen to it or share it with a friend, it'll be available as a podcast on our website by the end of the week. And now let's welcome our first panel, John Adams, Peter Sellers, Gerald Finley, James Cuno, and Wynne Della Coma. Thank you.
Well, again, now that we're properly situated, welcome. We're very happy to see you here. Let me tell you how I'm going to be starting this panel. I essentially want to start with a question for each one of our guests, and then we will see where the conversation takes us. One note, we are limited in time, and if you don't think that you're hearing enough from John Adams, you can tune in tomorrow on WFMT from 10 to noon when he will be the guest host. So we'll make a note of that. All right, John, I would like to start with a question for you. We know that the opera grew out of a commission from the San Francisco Opera. Essentially, they were looking for an opera based on a Faust theme, with J. Robert Oppenheimer as the protagonist. I gather you were not keen on the Faust idea. But I'm interested in how you and Peter, who I know you always hash these things out, but how you go from a general idea, something as vague and big as Faust, to a lively, entertaining evening of opera that will keep people in their seats for 2 to 3 hours. Was it difficult in this case? How did you have musical ideas right from the beginning, or?
I thought that the suggestion was made by Pamela Rosenberg, who had a brief but really imaginative and exciting tenure as general director of the San Francisco Opera. And even before she took over, she contacted me because I live in Berkeley, California, and said, I'd love to talk to you about making an opera. And she did mention the fact that she wanted to do a series of operas that were keyed to the Faust myth. And she wanted an American Faust, and she mentioned J. Robert Oppenheimer and his life, his very complex and important narrative, which took him from being a brilliant, if somewhat arrogant, student at Harvard and in Europe during the 30s, during the period when nuclear physics were actually discovered, to his shepherding of the Manhattan Project, and finally to his public disgrace when, during the McCarthy period, forces in Washington decided that his opposition to the nuclear arms race was causing a bit of cognitive dissonance, and he was basically tarred and feathered and humiliated and disgraced. So I think that's what Pamela, why she made the connection with Faust, the idea of someone who has great scientific gift and intellectual curiosity, so almost insatiable intellectual curiosity, and make some kind of bargain that allows him to go even further in this ability, but in the end has to pay a grievous price. So in that sense, it was a brilliant connection in Pamela's mind. I felt that the Faust myth, it made me a little uncomfortable for two reasons. One, I didn't think it was American enough. And my operas really are about the American experience. I really want to probe what I feel is the sort of national psyche, whether it's market economy versus social welfare, which is basically what Nixon and China is about, or our gross misunderstanding of the rest of the world, which is what the death of Klinghoffer is about, and on and on. But I felt that this was a heroic story, and Aristotle says that a tragic character should be a person of noble standing, and I thought that Oppenheimer indeed filled that role. And so right off, I knew that I had a great story, and it was a question of finding a locus, finding a time span, finding an actual center point in the story of his life that could radiate out to all these other subjects. And that's where Peter is so wonderful in sort of locating that structure. And together over about a year's period, Peter and I met in the same coffee shop in Berkeley, California, and to the accompaniment of hissing espresso machines, we developed this libretto.
Which then leads us to Peter. I'm thinking to myself, if you were proposing this concept for an opera like Nixon in China, if you were proposing it in Hollywood, it's going to be a killer. It's on, it's on the economy. It's on capitalism. Not exactly the sort of thing that a producer would think that, they would fill millions of seats in theaters with. Peter, can you talk about this element of going from myth to individual characters? You really can't. Do you want to write an opera about the terrors of the nuclear age, or do you want to write an opera about an interesting person caught in those issues?
What you learn in theater is the answer when you have a choice of one thing or another is all of the above. In fact, in the age of the soundbite, what we're trying to accomplish is the three-course meal in sound. What would it be like to have something to really chew on? What would it be like where the consequences are so large for a lot of the things that each of us do every day that we don't really think have large consequences, and we get away with it, or we're thinking nobody's looking, or we're hoping somebody's noticing. But in fact, someone like J. Robert Oppenheimer is operating on the world's largest stage. And that stage, Time Magazine, father of the atomic bomb, all over the world, that kind of visibility creates its own mythology. And John's operas have always been about that mythology. Nixon, Mao Zedong, Zhou Enlai, these are people who lived during our lifespan on Earth and also are mythic. And we use them as projection screens in which to project all of our emotions, everything we hate, everything we love, everything we care about is projected onto those figures. And of course, the other thing that's that's very important, as John said, about, you know, the way the Aristotelian Greek tragedies work, is that the audience walks in knowing so much more than the characters. By confining the opera to a single 24-hour period in 1945 on July 16th, nobody on stage knows what happened next. Nobody on stage knows what Hiroshima will be. Nobody knows what Nagasaki will be. Nobody knows what the arms race will be. But we do. And so the way Greek tragedy works, classically, in Euripides, in Sophocles, and in Aeschylus, is that we know how Oedipus Rex ends. The only person who doesn't know it is Oedipus Rex and Jocasta. And we watch people make choices that you want to say, wait a minute, stop. No, that's not such a good idea. You think you know everything, but there are a few things you're unaware of or actually in denial about. And we sit there while these people repeat a series of things we now come to realize are mistaken based on what they think they know. And that's very profound. And I think that was the Greeks' way of saying democracy has to have within it an actual built-in structure that insists that we learn from history. And that's why they invented the theater. And why the theater had to go in tandem with the Senate. Because in the Senate, you could say anything, and in the theater, there were higher standards.
A major point we will keep in mind as we're listening to Senate debates and not going to the theater, yes? Mr. Finley, I wanted to ask you about portraying a character who was alive and walking the earth within modern times. We certainly know you from Lyric in roles like Papageno, and your repertoire goes from Handel to Oppenheimer. Can you tell me a little bit about developing this character, how you developed him and what you needed to do?
Well, first of all, it was a huge honor and privilege to be involved in the creation of the character and of the piece. Both John and Peter were tremendously generous in their advice and collaboration in putting the part and musical elements together. It was, of course, as both John and Peter have said, Oppenheimer himself is a character about which a mythology has grown up. And the source material for exploring his thoughts and his way of life and his whole view on what he was doing at any particular time, it's quite well documented. During the course of the lead up to the opera in San Francisco, a number of biographies came out and descriptions of the activities going on in the Manhattan Project, and so that was incredibly useful for information. What was a challenge for me, of course, was to, as Peter has just suggested, was not to get beyond the character of 1945, because I don't think I've seen any televisual archive of J. Robert Oppenheimer before 1945. Mm-hmm. And so to embody physically, in thought and mind, how he might have been, what energy he had, is not there on film. What there is on film is a broken man and someone who equally passionately found a way of surviving in the having been thrust then into the lion's den, a man who was there trying to survive the decisions that he had made previously. So for me, it was really a question of saying, okay, where do I go back to? How can I get inside this incredibly complex man? There's a wonderful description, I'm sure, Mr. Sherwin will be pleased to know I read his article in the Chicago Tribune this morning about Oppenheimer. And there in the first paragraph is a complete catalog of what complexity this man had. Now, of course, in 2.5 hours, one's not on stage in an opera, one's not probably going to be successful in portraying every single little element of it. The job as a singer, of course, is to respond to the music and how that music has subconsciously or telling or describing what is going on inside the character with the words that he's speaking and yet the emotional content behind it. And, of course, that's something that could only happen while I was learning those notes in the last few months and with Peter and John during the last parts of rehearsal. So the character has developed very much even since those first rehearsal days. And I'm pleased to say that here in Chicago we have a many facets of Oppenheimer's character. And it's been a real privilege to explore all those.
I was going to say, and it continues to develop, doubtless, over performances.
Yes, and as new information comes to my knowledge, I took the radical step of going to Santa Fe and going to the ranch that Oppenheimer first learned to horse ride. And I've been to his house, or the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, where he had a retreat there, where he found peace and solace and get a feeling of the atmosphere, just the entire spiritual element of the man, which is less well documented. I didn't learn Sanskrit for his knowledge of the Bhagavad Gita.
And I'm sure it shows in the performance.
However, as each time, each minute goes on, yeah, there's always a little bit more one can offer.
Which leads to a question I would like to ask Mr. Cuno. I'm sure we will discover it a little bit more in the second panel, but it's very interesting. The major physicists who were involved in this project were not simply narrow-minded scientists the way sometimes musicians or writers can be narrow-minded only knowing their own background. Oppenheimer certainly and other ones very interested and knowledgeable about music and visual art and theater and poetry particularly. And I'd like to ask Mr. Cuno a question about sort of what was the artistic environment of the U.S. at that particular point? What were they thinking about as they were maybe reading contemporary poets or looking at contemporary music and art?
Well, I'm glad you asked that because I was hoping you would, because I was thinking about that this morning, and I was thinking that something that's consistent in the development, artistic development, visual artistic development in this country, and the development of, and the history of the development of these ideas that lead to through the Manhattan Project to the atom bomb, is this incidence of a transfer of knowledge that is from Europe to this country, such that scientists, as we know from the late 30s and so forth, coming in numbers and bringing with them some critical understandings of the issues that they would later deal with in development of the Manhattan Project, coming to this country from Germany particularly, but from Europe. It's true also with artists who had been coming since in great numbers in any case, since the latter part of the 1930s, and with the surrender of Paris, 1940, in even greater numbers still. So the sense of transfer of knowledge seems to be coincident, but equally there's this sense, this haunting image of Oppenheimer having in his pockets Baudelaire and the Bhagavad Gita, I think, if I recall and if I pronounced it correctly. But in any case, these ancient sources of literature on the one hand and then modern avant-garde source of literature on the other hand, the one hand myth and the other hand dream. And clearly what the Europeans brought with them, at least the avant-garde Europeans brought with them to this country, was these poles of what we call the legacy of surrealism, and that is dreams on the one hand and myth on the other. Such artists as Max Ernst, for example, dealing with the iconography of myth, or with Dali or Mata dealing with the visual imagery of dreams, and a kind of respect for this alternative to the reality, the visual world, the scene world that was prevalent in this country. What was clear, part of this legacy, was that you could no longer take for granted what you saw, that things weren't as they seemed to be, and that they weren't going to stay that way very long either, that things were constantly in some stage of evolution, or at least of significant change. And so we see that in the work of these European artists who come to this country and dominate the imagination of the young avant-garde artists, contrary to the older American artists whom we identify with a kind of celebration of regional culture and recognizable and representational culture. So you have this clash between the abstract or between the automatic, between the unconscious and between the social and the seen and the experienced and the representational. And that clash is what's defining of those years just prior to the bomb and ultimately the success and triumph of the influence of the European modernists and the avant-garde in the development of American painting with Pollock and Rothko and Newman in particular.
I would like to ask a question. I'm very interested in the nuts and bolts of how things get put together, how an aria ends up at the end of Act One as opposed to the end of Act Two, where there is a duet, where there is a chorus. I wonder if we could ask John and Peter to talk a little bit about the process of thrashing that all out and making a decision that finally you are going to be settling on these particular hours, or that the focus will be this particular time and place and these particular characters. We can maybe leave out too much caffeine and too much kissing espresso.
Well, of course, you know, the first sketches are ridiculously different from what we end up with. In every instance, I can, you know.
What did you start out with that perhaps?
Oh,
you...
we had the very first time that we met, our original librettist was going to be Alice Goodman, who did the two great, great libretti for Nixon in China and Death of Klinghoffer. And we had several days of meeting with her, and we returned from those meetings with an opening scene that was a science fiction fantasy of post-nuclear holocaust and
I think that's
monsters. You know, I can't quite remember what the tone of that was going to be, but I remember that I'd gone back to my own childhood trying to remember what it was like to be a little boy growing up during the 50s, and the terrible, terrible fear that was being pounded into us daily about communism and about the Russians are coming and there's going to be a bomb dropped. And those of you who are my age or older can remember articles in Life magazine and Time magazine about family bomb shelters, which showed mom and pop and the kids and their you know, 8 months' store of food and water. So I wanted to bring in that idea of science fiction. And we also were out of our minds in thinking that this would be an opera that would not only take care of the Los Alamos event, but it would also go into the 50s, and the final scenes would involve the Senate hearings and when Oppenheimer's security clearance was taken away from him. But fortunately, as in all cases, we had a dose of reality and ended up confining this to a very, very short time period. I always like to start my operas with a chorus. It's not a cliche. It's just something I like to do because it kind of sets the collective unconscious rolling. And in this case, the opening chorus is... They are all the people maniacally working to get this bomb ready because you know, there was enormous pressure, first of all, because they thought they were in a race against the Nazis. And then when Germany surrendered, the pressure came from Washington, because Truman was in Potsdam, and literally this, you know, the world was being carved up into spheres of influence, and Truman wanted to know whether indeed we had this bomb, because then he could use it to, you know, claim a leg up on Stalin. So Peter found this chorus, well, not a chorus, it's the introduction to a book that was published in 1945 with the charming title, Atomic Energy for Military Purposes, the official report on the development of the atomic bomb under the auspices of the United States government, 1940 to 1945. This book came out in 1945, and when it was released, people in Washington absolutely freaked out because it included so much information about how to make a bomb. It was amazingly detailed. Peter, can you find the spot where, at the end of June?
It should be right there.
Is it right at the beginning?
Oh, my God. Here we go. Introduction, right there.
No, I'm looking for the end of June.
Oh, okay. Give me one
while he looks for that. But as Wynn mentioned, the libretto is created from original documents, either from books like this or from memoirs. We actually had to go to the family of Edward Teller and ask if we could use quotes from his memoirs. You know, they were very suspicious to start with, but eventually they agreed to it. And first-hand interviews that were collected by the filmmaker John Else in preparation for his wonderful film, The Day After Trinity, plus poetry that Oppenheimer loved, poetry by Baudelaire from the Bhagavad Gita and by John Donne. But I asked Peter, let's find something good for the chorus to sing at the beginning. And the image, of course, is the lab in Los Alamos. It's June 1945, and everyone, military personnel, medical personnel, scientists, physicists, people sweeping the floors, the Native Americans who had been sort of co-opted into this project, plus, of course, Oppenheimer, they're madly working on this. And I set for the chorus, and this is the first words you'll hear in the opera, this introduction from this book. And I set it to music that sounds like newsreel music. It has a kind of, you know, punchy, nervous ostinato with the orchestra kind of ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta- happening. The end of June 1945 finds us expecting from day to day to hear of the explosion of the first atomic bomb devised by man. All the problems are believed to have been solved, at least well enough to make a bomb practicable. You can imagine trying to set that word practicable. A sustained neutron chain reaction resulting from nuclear fission has been demonstrated. The conditions necessary to cause such a reaction to occur explosively have been established and can be achieved. Production plants of several different types are in operation, building up a stockpile of the explosive material. Although we do not know when the first explosion will occur nor how effective it will be, announcement of its occurrence will precede the publication of this report. A weapon has been developed that is potentially destructive beyond the wildest nightmares of the imagination. You could see how this really got my musical juices flowing, because it really does sound like the voiceover of a science fiction movie. A weapon so ideally suited to sudden unannounced attack that a country's major cities might be destroyed overnight by an ostensibly friendly power. If I sound like Dick Cheney, it really... This weapon has been created not by the devilish inspiration of some warped genius, but by the arduous labor of thousands of normal men and women working for the safety of their country. And this is the general summary of this book, atomic energy for military purposes. So it's an example of the kind of text that we found that, you know, it's interesting, it's spicy, it's delicious, but it's also an artifact of the era. It has that kind of language that was, you know, that wartime language, and yet it also gives us a real clear insight into the mindset of the people involved.
Well, if any of you want to come up here and cower underneath the desk, as we did in the 50s, after that particular reading.
And may I just riffing off from that, just that was a very courageous book. The scientists were determined that the U.S. government could not put a blanket of secrecy over this project. And very courageous scientists said, in a democracy, this must not be classified. The public, the voting public, needs to be informed. And the scientists very courageously tried to, and you could hear that they are writing before Hiroshima because they know they want this in print 3 weeks after Hiroshima to tell the American public what they're doing. And a lot of the libretto consists of very courageous statements made by the scientists here in Chicago, who Leo Szilard was here, the Nobel Prize winner James Franck, and who were truly concerned about the ethical and moral questions of the use of nuclear energy, and said, this is a democracy, and why should it not be discussed? And of course, science itself is a democracy, because language and discovery is shared worldwide among scientists, and you can't put barriers, artificial barriers. So this is also, and John's music reflects, you know, incredible courage. And I would like to also, just riffing from what James offered us, is just to emphasize, and maybe John, you'd say a word about the musical elements, because there's that newsreel music, but it's also the music of the immigrants. It's Stravinsky and Schoenberg living in Los Angeles. It is. And their music meets in John Adams' music, you know, and that was a divide that could never, a gulf that could never be bridged. As well as surrealism, you have a lot of the most progressive American artists thinking about Japan. And in fact, very influenced by calligraphy, very influenced by Buddhism, very influenced by Zen Japanese culture, which is on its way in the late 30s and into the 40s. You have Martha Graham working with Noguchi. You have an astonishing new visual imagination that's American. You also have the WPA movement. And don't hold your breath, the next one is on the way very shortly, of a nation recovering from a depression and not just jailing everyone who is out of work, but putting them to work and saying America should speak to itself its own values, and those should be in murals in every post office. And that sense of public art and the public responsibility of artists. And so all of those are flowing in, as well as artists engaged with Native America and the way Picasso was engaged with Africa, but of course more creatively because Native Americans were here in America and still are. This question of the interaction with those cultures, which was very, very intense artistically in the 20s and 30s. And, of course, the scientists would go down to the pueblos on feast days and be in the corn dance. And that sense of a shared space, aesthetically, artistically, of the imagination, as well as this kind of haunted, surrealist phase. And one of the things that we did in at Berkeley, the Pacific Film Archive made a survey of mad scientist films up to 1945, the kind of films that these scientists grew up watching, and then what happened after 1945 when surrealism and sci-fi went into wild new directions, and of course also the soundtracks. Anyway, all of these things go into the mix.
Peter, I wanted to ask you one thing about the use of choreography. I mean, John was talking about how he begins his operas with chorus, and choreography is so important in this opera. Why was that important to you? Why was that something?
Because opera is this total work of art. It should be inclusive. It should stretch all the boundaries, and it's about a shared, collaborative space, you know, which is one of the things we have to demonstrate to politicians every day. What does it mean to collaborate? What does it mean that there are multiple and differing points of view, and we are finding a home for them all on stage? And sophisticated adults are communicating with each other at very high levels of detail and with enormous attention. And so the collaborative space of opera is very, very important. Every one of John's pieces has had dance with Mark Morris, the first two, and of course Lucinda Childs and John go back very far, and they were of a generation that invented literally a new artistic language here in America. And Lucinda's work is immediately recognizable if you just see, you know, three bars of it. And for me, it was like inviting Martha Graham into the room, you know, somebody who is an American original and someone who is creating literally a new language in the history of an art form.
I have a question about how the opera has changed in the period. It was premiered in fall of 2005 in San Francisco. There was a production in June, I believe, in the Netherlands. This is the third. It will go on to, one hopes, a long and healthy life elsewhere. How has your conception of it changed? Any of you three, if you can talk about that.
Well, there's so many ways to talk about it. Well, first I had to get my math right. I said an opening line which came from the first chapter of this book. Matter can be neither created nor destroyed. And then I realized that E equals MC squared is exactly, you know, contradicts that. So I went back and I changed the course and said, have the course say, we believed that matter can neither be created nor destroyed. But now we know now that that is no longer so. But those are just little things.
Einstein has been dealt with in another opera, yeah. So.
You can attribute it to my intelligent design. Well, on a strictly nuts and bolts level, not being a singer, I don't always write perfectly for the voice. And the trouble is that, you know, singers tend to hold composers in such esteem that if a composer comes in, you know, with a ridiculously awkward melody, the singer will try it and it won't work, and the singer will think, oh, it's my fault. And I had this classic example with Jerry, who, you know, to my mind is the greatest living baritone. Not just for the beauty of his voice, but for the intelligence of his musicianship and his consummate acting on the stage. And there's one scene in the first act where Oppenheimer and his wife Kitty are in bed, and it's the only moment of tenderness and actual, you know, human tactile touch in this opera that's otherwise basically about men trying to invent machines to kill people, not to put too fine a point on it. And we have this scene where an exhausted but preoccupied Robert Oppenheimer is in his pajamas in this bed, and his wife, who, like all the wives at Los Alamos, were distraught and distracted. They were given no real credit, for many of them were scientists themselves, but no advantage were being taken of that. And so you can imagine this woman who herself, Kitty Oppenheimer, had been a biologist and who was just bored out of her mind, angry, spent a lot of her time drinking, desperately wanting attention from her husband. So it's a love scene in which she's not getting what she needs from him. And what we put in their mouths are two very different poetries, one by an American poet, Muriel Rukeyser, beautiful poem, Am I in Your Light, where Kitty says this wonderful thing. He's reading his reports, and she's trying to get his attention, and her lines are, Am I in your light? No, go on reading. And he finally is aroused. He finally gets it. And he responds to her. His way of sort of making love to her is to sing this incredibly florid, sensual poem by Charles Baudelaire. And I set it in a very florid, sensual, kind of French-flavored mode that has resonances of Debussy and Daphnis and Chloe and very, very florid. And I imagine that's what Oppenheimer was like, that he could go from thinking about neutrons to being completely dazzled by a Mozart piano concerto or a John Donne sonnet. But what I set was parts of it were very awkward and very, very high up. I'm always worried that you won't be able to hear the singer, so I always write way too high. And I sent it to Jerry. I think I probably faxed it to him. And God bless him, he went into a studio in London and sang it for me so that I could hear it. But he just didn't, he didn't want to say to me, John, this line really stinks. And we went round and round with it. I finally got him to agree to maybe a few of my decisions were really making his voice sound unpleasant. And I think one of the problems with contemporary composers is most of them have not studied the voice, and they treat the voice as if it were a piano or a trumpet. And so you get these awkward intervals, and the voice doesn't sound attractive. You see the throat and the you know, the muscles around the face are all tight because the singer's desperately worrying about whether he's going to get the next note or not. So we went back and forth, and I think what we have now is a little more singable.
Yeah. Well, what's fantastic is actually we've pretty much come back to the original.
Now it can be revealed, yes.
You mean you the species has evolved?
Mutated, yeah.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because often one gets the feeling that singers are very happy to be dealing with dead composers, that Mozart will not be coming up and tapping them on the shoulder and saying, got to change it. But you evidently feel differently. You enjoy working with
them. Well, of course. I mean, the great, you know, time that we live in, is it is possible to exchange WAV files, you know, on the internet, and be able to instantly communicate about what ideal tessitura or word setting or indeed adjustments in the actual pitch values, and that was a wonderful thing with John. And at all points, it was an open door. So yeah, of course, it was a gift of generosity to be able to access John's creativeness there.
Peter, what about the change in the production? How are you looking at it differently, if you are?
It's all new. No, I mean, again, you get up every day and you have more ideas, hopefully. I think that's what it means to be alive. You know, and so... You know, it's a living, breathing entity. The cast has shifted from the original grouping, and in a couple of instances, we have the fantastic Jessica Rivera, who has really taken over Kitty Oppenheimer, and John has lifted the role to a soprano role, so it's blazing in texture. in this otherwise dark landscape. And the and of course, you know, the first time out, John's music is very difficult, and the singers are really working hard to count and be accurate, and the orchestra has a huge role, and everybody is super concentrated, which is what gives a new opera that kind of Olympics quality of you have to exceed and break all previously known records for human concentration and achievement. And it's what makes a premiere thrilling, but also incredibly unsatisfying interpretively, because we're not yet to the place we can genuinely interpret. We're just trying to get it mostly right. And a couple of years into it, you can begin to, well, I'll let Jerry say that, internalize the rhythms and not feel everything's coming from outside you, but I'm able to turn it around and feel that the performance is actually being generated from within by you, and you're not just in this big machine. And so the singers are gradually able to relax within John's music, and at the same time, the music insists that everybody has an edge all the time, which is fantastic. And so we get this really different quality a couple of years later from this opera. At the same time, I made a bunch of staging decisions that were just inept and inadequate in the premiere, particularly in the second act, and I was shockingly inadequate. So the second act has been restaged almost entirely and is very different for anybody who saw it in San Francisco. It's come to a very different place. But again, that's why we call it classical music, is that you weren't finished with it the first time. You know, there's a reason to play that Mozart symphony again. And maybe when we play it again, we'll find something we didn't find the first time. And maybe when we hear it again, we'll hear something we didn't hear the first time. And classical music means that it's a life work. We are going to live with these pieces and measure our lives against them for decades. And these pieces will deepen as our responses to them deepen. And every generation will find what it's looking for in the mirror of this piece. And so that's why I'm so grateful to be able to do it in Chicago. These pieces are not done at their world premiere. They are begun at their world premiere. And it is across the following decades that we humanize them and we begin to live with them, and they become part of our lives, and we're able to really enter them and ourselves live there. And maybe, Jerry, you...
I think, I mean, just absolutely picking up on what Peter said, our greatest challenge as actors and singers on the stage is to make every moment the truth, so that essentially what's coming out of your mouth and where you are in the story is immediate and absolutely the truth for that moment. And when you're dealing with music, which is incredibly difficult to learn, and there is part of your brain which is always going 1, 2, 3, and in order to calm that voice and then let the character reveal itself is really a privilege of being able to live with a piece for much longer. I know that John prides himself on having the music composed well in advance for premieres. And for those of us that have worked on other world premieres where the music did, in fact, arrive the week before the premiere, this was a huge gift to actually allow at least the music to embed itself a little bit earlier. And from that point of view, I'm glad that the premiere had a substantial working in with orchestra. I mean, the first time we learned the music was through a MIDI computerized version of the orchestra. So when we heard the orchestra for the first time, it was completely incredible. And now, when we've had the chance to perform this 2 or 3 times now, the piano rehearsals for the next run have always been very unsettling, because the piano can't possibly give all those colors. And some of those colors are the key moments of emotion or of entry or of encouragement to come in. And so it's been wonderful to reach the orchestral stages here again to really feel that that's, you know, we've got something special again.
I wish we could go on forever, but I feel a doomsday clock is coming. So we thank you very much. We'll take a short break and we will return and we will be speaking about physics.
You've been listening to Backstage at Lyric, the podcast that takes you behind the scenes at Lyric Opera of Chicago. Backstage at Lyric features interviews with the creative forces behind the productions in the 2007-2008 season. For additional interactive content and to order tickets, visit us online at lyricopera.org.